Swing into Seaside Golf in Ocean City, Maryland. Play like a pro at 17 championship courses designed by golf legends like Jack Nicklaus and Arthur Hills. Tee off on sweeping vistas at Eagle's Landing. Savor the coastal views of Lighthouse Sound. Or see why Ocean City Golf Club is considered one of the Mid-Atlantic's finest fairways. Whether you're sneaking in a quick round on a family vacation or going all in on a golf getaway, fun is always in play at Ocean City, Maryland. Plan your trip at OCOcean.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. No kid forgets getting his first bike, nor the surge of independence he felt the first time he pedaled away from his parents. And even as adults, the bike seems to give off a feeling of romance, of freedom, and when you get going fast enough, even of flying. The special allure of the bicycle can really be traced back to its simple yet elegant design. My guest today will unpack the intriguing history of its creation. His name is Jody Rosen, and he's the author of Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle. Today on the show, Jody explains the origins of the bicycle's design, including how it was an anachronism at its birth, may have been inspired by a volcanic eruption, and helped liberate mankind from dependence on draft animals for transportation and exploration. We also get into how the bicycle was associated with flight right from the start. Along the way, we discuss how cycling represents an uncanny fusion of man and machine and produces a set of one-of-a-kind pleasures. This episode will make you want to mount your trusty bicycle steed and take a ride. After it's over, check out the show notes at aom.is/bike. All right, Jody Rosen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Brett. Glad to be here.
So you've been an avid cyclist since childhood. You ride a bike for transports, how you get around. You've never owned a car. And you got this book out called Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle. And this book, it's really wide ranging. It's a cultural history of the bike where you delve into different ways the bike has impacted our life from, you know, you got politics, even how our physical landscape has been shaped. And also this book, it really seems like it's a love letter to bikes. And I kind of want to focus on that romance today because I've always noticed there's this sort of allure around bikes. Like it's something magical about them. You know, kids getting their first bike, you know, you got Elliot flying on his bike over the moon with E.T. And I think a lot of this romance about the bike goes back to its design. It's really simple. It's like two wheels, you got handlebars. And because it's so simple, I think a lot of people would think, well, man, some version of the bike has been around for a long time, but they're actually a relatively recent invention. So what was considered the first bicycle and when was that made?
Yeah. So the first bicycle, which I guess you could kind of call a proto bicycle, arrived a little over 200 years ago. I guess if we're crunching the numbers, 205 years ago in 1817 in the Duchy of Baden in the German Federation in the city of Mannheim. So this is a bicycle that was invented by a minor German nobleman named Karl von Dreis. And he called the thing the Laufmaschine or the running machine. He called it that because this first bicycle had no pedals. So it was a little bit like those, in fact, very much like those balance bicycles that you see little kids riding or, you know, kind of scooting along the ground in order to like learn to balance their bodies on the bike. It was a machine that had two wheels in a line, you know, one in front of the other. That was the crucial breakthrough, the kind of crucial insight that Karl von Dreis made, that you could have a machine that worked like that with two wheels lined up in a row as opposed to on either side of an axle. And he, you know, kind of linked those wheels with a saddle or a seat in between. But the device was propelled by this kind of scooting or ice skating motion where he, you know, you literally ran your feet along the pavement to propel the thing. So in that way, it was definitely different than the bicycle that we know today, the kind of classic bicycle, which has two wheels, but has a chain drive and pedals. This is a very much a first pass. So what's curious, I think, about it, you know, and kind of important to take on board is the fact that the technology to build that thing had existed since the early Middle Ages, but it took many, many centuries of trial and error for humanity to arrive at a bicycle. So in a way, I say in the book, it kind of arrived illogically late. We think of the bicycle as something that could have been, should have been around, you know, forever, since antiquity or whatever. But in fact, the bicycle, when it arrived in 1817, the steam locomotive had already been invented 15 years earlier. And by the time we got, like, the bicycle's design was kind of perfected in the 1870s, 1880s, the automotive age was dawning. So the bicycle is this kind of strange, you know, anachronism at birth.
You know, this Drace guy, why did he decide to design this thing? Was he just like, is it for fun, or was there actually, did he have a practical purpose in mind?
Yeah, so he was a kind of a tinkerer and inventor. that's what he did for fun, or he viewed this as his kind of calling in life. I mean, he was technically a forester. He had kind of like a bureaucratic job, but because of his aristocratic background, this was sort of a position where he drew a salary for not doing much work, and what he really spent his time doing was dreaming up new machines. And he was pretty successful in his inventions. I mean, he didn't just invent a bicycle; he invented like stenography machines and various other devices. So he was a very clever guy. But the context for the invention of the Lauf machine was, well, for one thing, he'd been experimenting with devices of this sort, with transportation devices, for some time. He'd gotten in his head that we needed a better means of moving across land than either on foot or on some kind of a horse-drawn vehicle. So he was seeking a replacement horse. And in the period that he invented this, in 1816, was a tumultuous and important year, now maybe largely forgotten historically, but there was a giant explosion of a volcano, eruption of a volcano on an Indonesian island in 1815, which shot, you know, great quantities of volcanic ash up into the atmosphere. And that kind of ash cloud drifted west. So by the summer of 1816, you had a kind of a veil of volcanic ash literally dimming the sun. So this was known across the Western world, in Western Europe and the United States, as the year without a summer. And so some historians have speculated that it was the fact that there were shortages of oats due to the terrible climatic conditions, which was killing off horses, which turned the Carl von Drace's thoughts to the idea of a replacement horse, because, you know, there were not as many horses around, and the horses in question were in bad shape. Also, it's been speculated that because of the ice that was everywhere in Germany during that summer of 1816, he was seeing people ice skating around, and that might have spurred the idea for a machine, a wheeled device that you propel by using an ice skating motion. But this is just speculation. There's no confirmation of exactly what the eureka moment was, or what the pattern of thinking that led him to this thing was. We can just say that he's a guy who liked to invent things and was very interested in the problem of transport.
Well, and so I think it's interesting, this connection between, you know, the bike trying to be a potential replacement for the horse. Since that time, the horse and the bike have been connected. Oftentimes, bike companies use a horse as a logo for their bike, their bicycle.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's really like, I mean, just to take it back, like, the bicycle was a solution to a really age-old problem, an age-old dream, which is this quest for a transport device that could help humankind travel across land swiftly under their own power, that is opposed to in some sort of cart or carriage that was pulled by a draft animal. You know, prior to the time of the bicycle, you had to hitch up some sort of wheeled contraption to a horse or a donkey or a dog if you wanted to, like, move swiftly across the land using any other means other than your own 2 feet. So yeah, the bicycle instantly was recognized by Drace and by others as a kind of replacement for the horse. And throughout its history in the 19th century, there was this kind of conflict between the bicycle and the horse, between people who were involved in industries that were, you know, horse-centric industries, everything from, you know, hackney carriage drivers to owners of stables to veterinarians to, you know, blacksmiths who made horseshoes. People in these industries were threatened by the advent of the bicycle because it was seen as, you know, potentially, and not incorrectly, as something that would lead to the obsolescence, or, you know, at least the diminishment of those horse industries. And there was a whole class component to this too, because, you know, eventually once we got a bike that was a cheaper bike available to the masses, suddenly you had many, many, many millions more people who could afford a form of personal transport than you had in a period when, you know, people had to rely on say a hackney carriage because those were expensive. And so, you know, transport prior to the arrival of the bicycle, land transport was really a class stratified. If you were rich, maybe you could travel around on a horse or in a horse drawn carriage. If you weren't, yeah, you were stuck going on foot.
Well, okay. So, but before the bike became democratized, and we'll get to talk about the safety bike, that was the big innovation. So this thing that Drace made, it got imported across Europe. And the first people that really took a hold of it were the elite, were sort of like the aristocracy. They had the money and time to walk around on these things. And it caused like sort of this early craze in the Regency era. So it's like the early 19th century. They called it the velocipede. Tell us about this craze. What was going on? Who was riding these contraptions?
Yeah, that's right. So Carl von Drace was kind of like he was a great promoter of his machine, and he tried to sort of spread the vogue for it across Europe. It first reached Paris and then very quickly crossed the Channel. And as you say, there was kind of a big fad for it in Regency England, particularly among the elites, among literal aristocrats, and more to the point, young fashion conscious aristocrats who were kind of into the latest technology. So, you know, new weird devices. So yes, what they called the velocipede, which literally means swift, you know, is from the Latin meaning swift of foot. So it was also called the swift walker. It had many nicknames, but notably, some of those nicknames were the dandy charger, the dandy horse. This is because it was associated with these dandies, with these, you know, very flamboyantly dressed young rich Englishmen who had the money to afford what were fairly expensive machines. And they were, you know, known to ride these things in kind of CNBC spots in London, particularly Hyde Park was a hot spot for velocipede riding. And even the Prince Regent, George, who was, you know, a famously dissolute character known for throwing lavish parties and stuff, he bought a bunch of these things and kept them at his crazy palace in the seashore city of Brighton. So the velocipede very quickly in England developed a reputation as a kind of plaything of the rich. And as a result, there was a lot of animosity towards it, you know, populist resentment towards it among the masses. It was viewed as another sign of the decadence of the moneyed classes. And so there was a big backlash for that reason against this machine. But there, and perhaps even bigger reason for the backlash is these velocipedes, you know, Drace's device wasn't really particularly well engineered. It in particular had problems with its brakes. So they were viewed as very dangerous. And this was the kind of very first iteration of a conflict, which we see to this day over the right to the roadways. That is the bicycle, the velocipede, in this case, was viewed from the start as a kind of illicit or illegitimate machine, which was claiming space that didn't belong to it, both on the roads themselves, because that was thought to be the domain of you know, horses and horse-drawn carriages, and on the pavements, the sidewalks, which was, you know, considered the place where you walked on foot. So bans were instituted very quickly after a kind of craze for these things in, particularly in the year 1819. By the time you get to 1820, there are bans imposed on velocipede riding in London. And when this same velocipede reached places in the United States, cities there imposed bans. There was even a ban instituted as far away as Calcutta. So what we see there is, like, you know, the very beginning of a pattern that has continued throughout the history of the bicycle, which is these kind of like culture wars and conflicts over, you know, whether the bicycle is a device that has a place on the road or should be, you know, marginalized and kept off the streets.
Okay, so the velocipede, it still had no pedals. When were pedals added to the bike?
So basically the story of the bicycles, you know, development is a decades long story of kind of experimentation. And there are various inventors and engineers who had a role in this, but there's kind of two major bike booms or bike boomlets, you might say, that preceded the big bike boom of the 1890s. And in those cases, in the kind of 1860s, you had a bicycle known as the Bone Shaker, because it had iron shod wheels and a wooden frame, and it was quite uncomfortable to ride, particularly over, you know, flagstone pavements. But this is a bike that had a direct drive, so that the pedals were on the front wheel itself. And then in the 1870s, you had the invention of the iconic penny farthing or high wheeler bike. This is that famous crazy looking bicycle with a giant front wheel and the small rear wheel. Again, this is a direct drive device. And the reason you had that huge wheel was because that created a gearing effect, because basically you needed that big front wheel because it was a direct drive, because you were pedaling, you were using pedals that were directly attached to the hub of that front wheel. The bigger the wheel, the bigger the rotation you would get for each pedal stroke, and you know, you would travel farther and faster because of that. The issue with these earlier bicycle designs is that they're unsafe. Again, they were like, if you've seen pictures, images of those, maybe even in real life, you've seen one. There's some around of those penny farthings. They are really tall, so they're hard to mount. In fact, they were sort of at the height of a horse. That's kind of why they were at that height. So it's difficult to mount in the first place. And once you got up there, because of that direct drive, huge front wheel, they were hazardous to ride. People were prone to kind of flying over the handlebars, what was called in the period, taking a header. So you had lots of people, you know, kind of riding along and then pitching over the handlebars and smashing their head on the pavement. So clearly those are beautiful looking things, but it was still, you know, we're talking now 50 years after the invention of the Laufmaschine. We still had an imperfect bicycle.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Texas Pete is the sauce that allows you to sauce like you mean it. Each Texas Pete sauce is packed with a bold, balanced flavor. The signature tanginess is what makes it a legendary hot sauce that can be used on just about anything. You're definitely going to want to try every flavor. The original hot sauce has a famous secret blend of fermented peppers. Their hotter hot sauce is 3 times hotter than the original, and it's not for the faint of heart. They also got a flavor called Sabor by Texas Pete, adds authentic Mexican flavor. And they also have a dust dry seasoning that matches the flavor of the original hot sauce in a flavorful dry rub. But the flavor that I've been enjoying lately is the chop sriracha sauce. It's got chili, garlic, and some tropical tangy notes. It's really good. I love putting on my eggs. Texas Pete, sauce like you mean it. Visit TexasPete.com and use the store locator to find Texas Pete products, as well as purchase sauces and get recipe inspiration. And you can use promo code PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. That's PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. Check out the Sriracha Cha Sauce. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. If you're like me, you've probably signed up for subscription services, but then you forgot about them. I'm talking about newsletters, streaming services, things like that. Well, with the personal finance app Rocket Money, it can help you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It can also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I had a chance to use Rocket Money, connected it to my checking account, and it found a bunch of subscription services that I forgot about. I was able to cancel them, and I was able to save a lot of money because the stuff adds up. Besides canceling your unwanted subscriptions, Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you, up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness, rocketmoney.com/manliness. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass.
This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn the art of negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss.
And now back to the show. And when did they add the chain? Like, when did that happen?
So that was, it was the late 1870s where the first designs for what came to be called the safety bicycle emerged. And then it was around 1885 that we had the first, you know, mass manufacturing of, yes, what was called the safety bicycle. And of course it was called that because, you know, in contrast to the earlier types of bikes, it was safe. You had two wheels of, at first, close to equal size, and then very quickly thereafter, you know, absolutely equal size wheels. You had a diamond shaped frame, the rear driven, you know, chain drives such that when you turn the pedals, it was attached to the rear wheel and kind of dragged that rear wheel forward. And then suddenly you could just use the front wheel simply to steer, which is a much easier and you know, better thought out system than that direct drive system. And so you have this kind of classical bicycle silhouette arriving in 1885, and into the 1890s. And crucially, you also had pneumatic rubber tires, that is a tire which had a rubber inner tube filled with compressed air, which made a bicycle ride both much smoother and much faster. And this is not just the classic design, but kind of the unvarying design. You know, every bicycle that has come around ever since has more or less, you know, the changes to that design have been basically ornamental. Suddenly in the late 1870s, early 1880s, you had, you know, a kind of a something close to a perfect device. You know, finally the bicycle itself, the true bicycle had arrived, and you know, that's the bike that we recognize today.
Yeah, and you had this chapter that I really enjoyed reading about, you know, how the bike is such a simple, it's like a simple design. I mean, it's just like you said, it's like diamond shape, circles. But it's very elegant, and you kind of make this case that the bike is one of the greatest human designed objects ever. Like, what is it about the bicycle that you think it makes it so great?
Yeah, I mean, simplicity is definitely part of it. You know what I mean? A bicycle has very few functioning parts. You know what I mean? To build one, you need just a few things. Unlike a car, right? Which it's like, you know, there's so many intricate parts you need, for instance, for an automobile. Well, a bicycle, there's only a few working parts that you need. And it's kind of a great example of simplicity in design, and kind of form follows function. Like, a bicycle is a very legible device. You can look at it and, you know, even a child can figure out like how this contraption works with just a little bit of like observation and maybe experimentation. So there's definitely a kind of austere beauty in its design. But I think the crucial thing about the bicycle is the fact that it is a vehicle whose rider is both the passenger and the engine. So, you know, it's one way of putting it is it's almost less a vehicle than it is a prosthesis. When you ride a bike, you sort of merge your body with the bike. You become, if you will, a component of the bike. So there's that really that feeling you get on a particularly great ride where it's almost uncanny feeling of being like, you know, one with the mechanism of the bike. And I think, you know, it's that uncanny quality of the bicycle, the fact that it's a kind of machine man hybrid, if you will, that makes it such a neat device and such a beautiful one.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because bike riding, you know, you might fall down a little bit when you first learn how to ride a bike, but once you do, it just seems like the most natural thing. It's like, well, humans were made to do this. But you think about it, like what goes on to ride a bike, you have to keep your balance, you have to pedal, you have to manage speed. It seems like, well, humans weren't designed for this, but we somehow make it work.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, I guess, you know, there's the expression, it's just like riding a bike, you know, which we mean, once you learn to ride a bike famously, you never forget, right? I mean, if you had some horrible, you know, brain trauma, that might be, that memory might be shaken out of your brain. But the fact is, the bicycle is, learning to ride a bike is one of these examples of a kind of memory that, or a kind of skill that you don't need recourse to conscious thought. Once you've learned to ride a bike, your body knows how to do it. And I think this lies in the fact that the only thing you really need to learn how to do when you ride a bike is how to balance, you know, how to keep, yeah. how to like straddle the bike and keep the thing from tipping over. In fact, what you're doing when you ride a bike is all the time, you're totally unconsciously making tiny little minor adjustments in order to keep the thing up. But once you've mastered, to go back to that, you know, the Laufmaschine and the kind of the balance bike that those little kids learn to ride on, you know, what we've realized is that when you're trying to teach a little kid to ride a bike, it's best to start them on one of those balance bikes that have no pedals, as opposed to a regular, you know, pedal bike with training wheels. Because what you need to learn in order to ride a bike is simply to balance the thing. It's not pedaling per se. So yeah, it's a skill that would seem to be something like a stunt. In a way, it is a stunt, but it's a simple stunt to master. And that's why, you know, so many people around the world, you know, ride bikes. I mean, like, you know, one thing that I say right in the beginning of my book is the fact that, you know, the bicycle is kind of hidden in plain sight. It's one of those things that we take for granted. And there are about 1 billion motor vehicles in the world. There are about 2 billion bicycles. And I think that speaks to the fact that, like, it's an easy thing to master. Also, it's cheap, so that helps.
So besides being associated with the horse, the bicycle right away, like especially in the 1890s, got associated with mythology and flight. What was going on there?
Yeah, I mean, to go back to, I spoke a little bit about the pneumatic rubber tire. You know, there's this kind of, people often say when they're on their bike, they feel like they're flying. They feel like a bird or something like that. And that was definitely, you know, rhetoric that was heard right from the get-go. The Laufmaschine, the Velocipede, was compared to Pegasus, you know, the flying stallion of Greek mythology. And then throughout the 19th century, people were always making analogies between flying and bicycling. And with the arrival of pneumatic rubber tire, this kind of metaphor became almost literal, because when you ride a bike, you are kind of riding on air. That is, you know, the air that's in the tires is literally holding you aloft. So the feeling of kind of skimming along like a bird is something that's, in a way, actually happening when you ride a bike. But there are other interesting connections between flight, aviation, and cycling, the most kind of dramatic of which is the fact that the Wright brothers, Orville and Wilbur Wright, the inventors of the airplane, were, of course, bicycle mechanics and manufacturers. And in order, when they were doing their experiments in their effort to invent a flying machine, an airplane, they used components straight out of their bicycle shop. They experimented, some crucial breakthroughs that they made, kind of understanding the mechanics of flight, were made because of experiments they performed with bicycle wheels and literally by riding around Dayton, Ohio on their bikes. And the kind of most important insight that they gained in their attempt to figure out how to work an airplane goes back to this question of balance. They realized that an airplane, like a bicycle, could be an inherently unstable mechanism that relied on the ability of the pilot to balance the thing. So, you know, the aviation age is a kind of direct outcome of the age of cycling. So those kind of metaphors, a sort of dreamy metaphors about bicycles as flying machines, advertisements in the late 1890s, which famous advertisements that depicted bicycles kind of soaring through outer space. These metaphors were literalized by the Wright brothers.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I mean, with the Wright brothers, they weren't using theory to figure out flight. Like, there really wasn't aerodynamic theory yet, really. And so they were just kind of using, like, they were like figuring out flight the same way you ride a bicycle. It's just you figure out the balance and then you kind of intuitively make adjustments on the fly.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and if you think about the Wright brothers early plane. I mean, it's not, you know, that it's not a jumbo jet, right? it's like a one man thing. So it's really, it's not even that different in the way it looks than a bicycle. And then you kind of have like a guy sitting on a saddle, you know what I mean? Flying that thing. And also in this period, there were, you know, particularly in the period of the 1890s, when suddenly bicycles were everywhere and there are, you know, millions of bikes everywhere and kind of, you know, especially in the West, in Western Europe and in the United States, there was this just mass obsession with the bicycle. There were all kinds of ideas, visions for bicycle-like flying devices. People were constantly patenting various types of, you know, bicycle airship hybrids, none of which got off the ground. Nowadays, we have machines that are like that, kind of, you know, pedal powered flying machines of various sorts. But the link that the Wright brothers made was one that would seem that was sort of intuitive to people in this period.
Okay, so in the 1890s, the safety bicycle is invented. There's this huge boom in bicycles in Europe and the United States. It represents this new form of democratic man-powered mobility. You know, people thought of it as a less expensive horse that never needs to be fed. And, you know, it brought not only a new way to travel the roads, but also a new way to explore the wilds, the wilderness. So who was the first guy that thought, you know what? What I really need is a bicycle. I want to take my bicycle and I want to ride it down this rocky mountain. So how did the mountain bike come about?
Well, you know, the impulse to ride bikes up mountains existed right from the get-go, or at least as soon as we had pedal-driven bikes. You know, there are famous travel logs in the 19th century written by people who, there's one written by a guy named Thomas Stevens, who rode his penny farthing, like, literally around the world. I mean, of course, he didn't ride it over the oceans. He took ships, but, you know, he used his penny farthing to ride up mountain ranges all over Asia and Europe and the United States. People pedaled over the Alps in the 19th century on these bikes. So there were people using bicycles on mountains for some time, but it was really in the late 60s and early 70s that various cultures of mountain cycling developed, particularly in the San Francisco Bay Area, where a group of people who called themselves a kind of collective who called themselves Repack kind of souped up these old Schwinn bikes, put much bigger tires on them, messed around with the gearing systems, and created bikes which, as you say, you could use to like bomb up and crucially down mountains and kind of go off-roading. And eventually these things were mass manufactured and marketed to far and wide, such that there, you know, not only is, you know, mountain biking become a huge recreational pastime for millions of people, but also people just simply use mountain bikes to get around town because they have these great suspensions, they're nicely engineered machines. But yeah, it's funny that, you know, mountain, you know, the impulse to kind of use a bicycle, not just to kind of like, you know, cruise around town, you know, just to get around, but really to push your body to its physical limit, to climb high peaks and then to, you know, brave steep descents, is something that's been with us for a long time and is a big, big feature of cycling culture.
So I'll admit that while I had a bike when I was a kid, I have a bike now, but I don't really use it as much.
Yeah.
For me, like, it feels uncomfortable, unnatural, hurts my butt. How might you make the case for a grown-up to rediscover the pleasures of biking?
Oh man. I mean, like, all I can say is it is, you know, it's to me, the only thing then better than riding a bicycle is sex. I'm going to be awesome. I'm going to be blunt about it. All right. You know what I mean? And riding a bicycle with your wife on her bicycle next to you is really fun. It's really fun too. No, it's an intensely physically pleasurable thing to ride a bike. It's a great way to go about your business and get around. You know, you kind of interact with the world in a different way when you're on your bicycle. You know, you move at a pace that's neither too fast nor too slow. So you can kind of soak in the panorama, you know, in a way that you can't when you're walking or in a car, and interact with your environment. in a way. So it's an intensely pleasurable bike for me, like sensual, emotional, and even intellectual experience. Like I think better when I'm on my bike. I'm a writer. So like, you know, like I'm a journalist. So sometimes when I get stuck on something, you know, have writer's block or whatever, and I need to kind of clear the cobwebs out, I'll just jump on my bike and ride around town for a little bit. And it has that effect for me. But yeah, I mean, I guess the other thing I'd say is simply convenience. It's just like we all spend our time, particularly if we're, you know, we are commuters, car commuters or on public transportation, kind of moving slowly, stuck in traffic, whatever. And once you start riding a bike, you realize what a pleasure it is to get around town and how relatively quicker you can get where you're going. So that's just the start of my case. Let's put it that way.
Well, Jody, this has been a great conversation. Where can people go to learn more about the book and your work?
Well, you can go to Google, and if you enter my name, JodyRosen, you'll find some articles I've written over the years for the New York Times. That's my main gig. But you could also go to my website, jody-rosen.com. Then certainly you can find my book, Two Wheels Good, at any bookstore or any online purveyor of books.
Fantastic. Well, Jody Rosen, thanks for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much. I've had a great time, Brett.
My guest today was Jody Rosen. He's the author of the book, Two Wheels Good. It's available on Amazon.com. Also, check out his website, jody-rosen.com, where you can find more information about his work. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/bike, where you can find links to resources and we can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Make sure to check out our website at artofmanliness.com, where you can find our podcast archives, as well as thousands of articles written over the years about pretty much anything you can think of. And if you'd like to enjoy ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast, you can do so on Stitcher Premium. Head over to stitcherpremium.com, sign up, use code manliness at checkout for a free month trial. Once you're signed up, download the Stitcher app on Android or iOS, and you can start enjoying ad-free episodes of the AOM podcast. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate if you take 1 minute to give us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Helps out a lot. If you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think we get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. Until next time, it's Brett McKay. Remind you to listen to AOM podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
Live life at your pace. Click the banner or go to visitwilliamsburg.com to discover how. Because here in Williamsburg, life moves at one pace, yours. Scramble through our world-class golf courses or shop your way through the square. Be one with nature as you hike or bike through our parks and trails or hunker down at one of our breweries. And when it's time to eat, be sure to bite into our eclectic food scene. It's all waiting for you in Williamsburg. Book your trip today and live life at your pace.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.